According to, I like the little voice that tells me recordings in progress, reminds me. Well, welcome everyone to Paradoxes class. This morning we have Dr. Fuzz Rana, who's a scholar with reasons to believe. He's a lot more than that, but he's at least a scholar with reasons to believe. And he's here today to make a presentation because Hugh Ross could not be here. So we're very happy to have you, Fuzz. Thank you for taking your time out of your own church life to be here with us and to teach us. Can you tell us a little bit about where we're going to be going today and why you did what you did?
Sure thing. Well, you know, I have a long history with the paradoxes class, but I don't think I've been involved with the paradoxes class, or at least appeared as a guest to the class for quite some time. But when I first started with Reasons to Believe over 22 years ago, I would actually wind up at the paradoxes class from time to time, making presentations and things like that. So it's been a while, and Hugh, is the adventurer that he is in Quebec with his wife, Kathy, doing some kind of mountaineering adventure. And so he asked if I would come to the class and speak. And I thought, yeah, it's been a while. So yeah, I'll be happy to do that. So anyway, so I'm looking forward to the time that we're going to hang out together. It's going to be a real treat. And I'm going to present a preview of a new book that I have coming out, we hope, in November. The book is at the printer, and in these COVID-19 pandemic days that we're in, nothing is delivered on time, so including books. So hopefully in the first part of November, we'll see the book. But the book's entitled Fit for a Purpose, and it's essentially taking a look at the idea of the anthropic principle and applying it to biochemistry.
When you were putting that book together, what stimulated you to work on that particular subject among all of the subjects that you have access to?
Yeah. Well, this idea for this book has been kind of brewing for easily a decade, where I had some preliminary ideas that, suggested there very well could be an anthropic principle that manifests in biochemistry, and began to just do a little bit of research and present, facets of the idea at more technical settings. And, over time, really, the book kind of developed. But it really represents, a book that was 10 years in the making, where much of that time was spent researching and collating information that, wound up in the book. And there's a lot of information that, didn't make the cut and didn't wind up in the book. So the case could actually be even stronger than what we present in the book, which is always the case. But
yeah, books do constrain, don't they?
Yeah.
Well, with that, why don't I let you go ahead and make your presentation now, and then if there's any questions, we'll follow them up afterwards.
Sure thing.
Thank you.
Okay, so as we've already discussed, based on the that brief introduction, an interview with Mark, is the title for the day's talk is Fit for a Purpose, and really probing the question: does the anthropic principle include biochemistry? And part of the reason why I was motivated to write this book is that I've been long interested in, making a case for a creator from biochemistry, in a sense, looking at different ways we could present a design argument for a creator's existence and necessary role in the origin, the fundamental design of life, and have produced a number of books over the years that have addressed this question. A collaboration with Hugh Ross called Origins of Life, The Cell's Design, Creating Life in the Lab. And so this is really the fourth installment in that, long-term project of looking for ways to make a design argument. And I think what we have in this book is a different type of design argument than you typically will see made by Christian apologists who are looking at biochemistry or the origin of life question. And yet the ideas that I'm going to be presenting really are not necessarily new in the broader sense, because when it comes to making a case for a creator, perhaps one of the most powerful evidences, at least from science, that people can bring to bear for, you know, again, God's existence and role in the origin and in the design of the universe is something called the anthropic principle. And we'll explain what this idea is in just a minute for those of you that are not familiar with this idea. But if you polled, you know, people about the, you know, the scientific evidence that they find to be most compelling for, again, God's existence and role in bringing the universe into being, they would point out the ideas connected to the anthropic principle more often than not. And the power of this argument is that this is not only an argument being advanced by Christian apologists, but it is an idea that has a deep-seated connection to work going on in cosmology and physics, where you will see a number of people that are non-believers who would essentially ascribe to the anthropic principle, though they may be reticent to accept the theological implications of this idea. And to me, the irony of this idea being really marshaled as part of the case for a creator is that the idea really, at least the modern conception of the anthropic principle, really traces its genesis to an atheist, the physicist Brandon Carter, who was taking part in a conference celebrating the work of Copernicus. And it was, I don't know, maybe the 500th year anniversary of Copernicus's birthday or death or a publication of a significant work of his. I don't remember the specific details now. And a lot of the discussion at the conference related to the Copernican principle, the idea that really the Earth isn't special, that our planet is an average planet orbiting an average star, part of an average solar system, part of an average galaxy, that there's nothing really special about our position or our location in the cosmos. We're not the center of existence. We're not the focal point of the universe's history. And so Carter presented a paper that took a contrarian perspective, where he argued that we actually live in the just right location and at the just right time in the universe's history, that if we lived at any other time or were situated in any other location, then we would not exist, that our existence is actually special in that sense. And this is what he called at that time the weak anthropic principle. And then he also argued that it's not just simply our location in space and our location in time, but it is also the fact that the constants that define the universe seem to be just right for life to be possible. And this is what he called the strong anthropic principle. Later, Tipler and John Barrow and Frank Tipler came along and redefined the weak and the strong anthropic principle, but this was Carter's definition. And what Carter did in this paper to make his point was he essentially did a counterfactual analysis where he theoretically allowed different constants of physics to vary in value while holding all the others unchanged. And what he discovered through that analysis is that the fundamental constants and parameters and characteristics that define the universe itself must be exquisitely fine-tuned for life to exist. They must assume these very precise values, and that if these values deviate ever so slightly from the values that they hold, the universe would be inhospitable to life. And Carter primarily looked at the effect of varying these constants on things like star formation and elemental production. But on that basis, he concluded that the constants of the universe appear to be just right in order for life to be possible. They appear to be fit, if you will, for a purpose. There's a fitness to the universe with respect to life. And just as an example of a couple of instances where we see this type of fine tuning, one would be, for example, the ratio of the electromagnetic force constant to the gravitational force constant. And if those values vary by even as little as one part in 10 to the 40th power, star formation would be impacted in such a way that life couldn't exist in the universe. More recently, people have demonstrated that the cosmological constant, which is a parameter that characterizes dark energy, can only vary by one part in, or less than one part in 10 to the 120th power, if you want life in the universe. And so this is highlighting the fact that the universe is just exactly the way that it's supposed to be for life to be possible, and that if it's any different, then life simply couldn't exist in the universe. And in fact, what's again eerie about the anthropic principle is that these fundamental constants seem to be arising out of the fundamental nature of the universe itself. And so this is in effect the anthropic principle. And I think it's easy to see why people would evoke this idea as an argument for God's existence. It lends itself to a design argument. Now, the question then becomes, well, if there is an anthropic principle in physics and in cosmology, what about other areas of science? Do we see anthropic coincidences in other areas of sciences, at the chemical level, at the biochemical level, at the biological level? And this idea, or the exploration of this idea, was first done, in at least in modern times, by Michael Denton in his book, Nature's Destiny. And I think maybe some of you are familiar with this book. And I'll say right here that I want to give credit where credit is due. Michael Denton has probably done more to shape my thinking as a Christian apologist than anyone has, apart from probably Hugh Ross. And though I've never met him, his work has been really influential in terms of how I think about the design argument and the case for a creator from the life sciences. But what Denton does in this book, Nature's Destiny, is argue that we actually see evidence for anthropic coincidences when we look at chemistry, when we look at biochemistry, and when we look at biology at different levels, at different regimes in living systems. And he argues that these anthropic coincidences, again, like the anthropic principle in cosmology, reveal design and purpose in the universe. Even though Denton is an agnostic, he sees this idea of the anthropic principle as having really teleological implications for the sciences in a broad sense. Now, I must confess that when I first read the book, I didn't really appreciate the full thrust of Denton's argument. It wasn't really until about a decade later that I began to see what I would consider to be anthropic coincidences myself, as I was studying different facets of biochemical systems in light of looking to make different types of design arguments. And it was at that point I really began to seriously wonder if indeed if the anthropic principle extended beyond just simply physics and cosmology. Could we make a forceful case for that? And I think the answer is actually yes. And what I've done in the book Fit for a Purpose is really take what I would consider to be scattered observations made by some scientists who have suggested that certain facets of biology or biochemistry seem to reflect anthropic coincidences, extend the ideas of Michael Denton, and kind of present a comprehensive case for the anthropic principle in biochemistry. That's the purpose of the book. And the idea would be that if indeed there is an anthropic principle, not only does this have implications for the design argument, but it actually has broader scientific implications impacting the origin of life question, impacting the astrobiology and the search for life beyond Earth and other disciplines would be impacted profoundly by the existence of the anthropic principle. So this is a question that goes beyond philosophy and theology and really extends broadly into different areas of science. And so what I would like to do here is just give you a preview of one example of an anthropic coincidence that we see in biochemistry that is rather significant, that's rather profound. But in order to do that, we need to make sure that we understand how to identify the anthropic coincidences, how to identify the signature for the anthropic principle. And so in order to do that, we're going to take a quick look at a manifestation of the anthropic principle in the arena of chemistry. Now, the way we're going to go about doing this is very different than we would do than the way we would seek after the anthropic principle in physics and cosmology, as you'll see in a minute. And I'll highlight some of those differences. Yet fundamentally, the reasoning is the same. The methodology is different, but the reasoning is fundamentally the same. Now, even though we've talked about Brandon Carter and Michael Denton and their work in looking at the anthropic principle, the real father of the anthropic principle is actually a physiologist at Harvard University who worked in the early 1900s. And his name was Lawrence Henderson. And if any of you have taken a biochemistry class, you would probably be familiar with the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation. Well, that Henderson is of Henderson, the Henderson-Hasselbalch fame. Lawrence Henderson was the originator of the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation. And he did a lot of his work characterizing the buffering system in blood. In his day, there were no such things as biochemists. So he's called a physiologist. If he was alive today working, he would be a biochemist. But Henderson had this realization that the chemical environment of the Earth is just right to allow life to be possible. Now, Henderson was an atheist, and he thoroughly embraced Darwin's ideas of evolution. But he argued that if the Earth didn't have certain chemical properties, that the environment of the Earth would be unsuitable for life, that evolution couldn't even happen unless the Earth had certain chemical properties. And he focused primarily on water, carbon dioxide, and on the organic compounds, that carbon compounds that make up organic chemicals. And Henderson concluded that these materials have these really unusual, odd properties that are just right for life to be possible, and that there's no other alternative materials that could substitute for them, and that these materials have their properties specified fundamentally by the very nature of the universe itself, and therefore evolution is not adapting to whatever is available. But evolution can only happen under certain environments that have to be just right initially to support life. And that we really are, it's a lucky happenstance that we're in a universe where we have this just right chemical environment that would permit evolution to take place. So he saw an interplay between the fitness of the environment and the fitness that is arrived at through the evolutionary process of natural selection. But again, he argued that natural selection couldn't even operate unless the Earth's environment was just right. Now, remarkably, these insights were coming in the early 1900s before we even had the theory for chemical bonding. And in a sense, what Denton does in his book, Nature's Destiny, is extend and modernize Henderson's ideas. And so what I'm presenting right now is a modern day version of the type of argument that you would see in Henderson's book called Fitness of the Environment. And there's a lot we could talk about in chemistry, but what I'm going to talk about is the carbon atom. And this is a really unusual atom that has the just right properties that make life possible. If you're going to have living systems, you need to have a diversity of molecular systems that have a wide range of different types of properties in order to sustain the complexity that you need for life. And it turns out that carbon uniquely has an incredibly rich chemistry. And some of the things that make carbon unique is its ability to form multiple bonds, and it can form up to, it forms four chemical bonds, but it can form also single bonds, double bonds, and triple bonds. It can form stable rings and chains where carbon atoms will bond with other carbon atoms to form rings and chains, and it can also form stable bonds with hetero atoms. And these set of properties make carbon, again, unique in its ability to produce organic materials. There's about 10 million organic compounds that have been discovered, just as an illustration of how complex carbon chemistry is. And if you go to graduate school and you have to decide on what area of chemistry you're going to specialize in, there's an area called organic chemistry that's devoted solely to the chemistry of carbon. And even within organic chemistry, there's different divisions that exist there. And then the other option is inorganic chemistry, which is the chemistry of all the other elements on the periodic table. And it's because these other elements have far reduced complexity to their chemistry, which is why they are all grouped together into this one broad area of chemistry as a discipline. Now, the question is, again, is carbon unique in its chemistry? And the way we would probe that question is by looking at the periodic table of elements, which is shown here. And carbon is element number 6. It's on the right-hand side. It's on the second row on the right-hand side. It's kind of like a pale green box. And the way that you look at the periodic table is that any element, all the elements that are in a row have similar chemical and physical properties. And so the element that's going to have the chemical properties most like carbon would be silicon, which is right beneath it. And when we look at the chemistry of silicon, we discover that silicon can't form strong silicon-silicon bonds. The element is highly reactive. It's susceptible to oxidation. This is really significant because when silicon oxidizes, it becomes silicon dioxide. It becomes sand. And silicon dioxide is a solid material. Now, why this is significant is because when you oxidize carbon, the carbon in its most oxidized state is carbon dioxide, CO2. It is a gas, and it is also water soluble. Now, this is significant because when you're trying to extract energy from materials in the environment to drive the operation of living systems, you essentially have to oxidize those materials. And the end product of oxidizing organic compounds is carbon dioxide and water. The end product of oxidizing or silicon-based compounds would be silicon dioxide. And this is a solid state material. Now, why this is significant is because in a cell, when it's undergoing metabolism, as it's generating CO2 as a waste product, it can literally dissolve in the cytoplasm and diffuse across the cell membrane and then escape the cell as a gaseous material. In other words, there's a built-in mechanism to eliminate cellular waste because of the nature of carbon dioxide. But this is one reason why silicon could never form an element that would be useful for life. Silicon hydrogen bonds are weak, and silicon compounds typically can't form long chains or stable ring systems. So the bottom line is that it's really unlikely that life could be based on silicon. And so in other words, what we've said is that carbon has the just right set of properties to build organic materials that are needed for life, and that there's no other chemical element that could function like carbon in this capacity. So it's unique. And if it wasn't for carbon, you know, then life simply, again, couldn't exist. And of course, the properties of carbon are fundamentally specified by the laws of physics. The fine tuning that we see in the constants of physics manifests in those values that we see manifest in the nature of chemical bonding, which dictates the chemical properties of silicon. So you can begin to see how there's an interplay between the anthropic principle in physics and in chemistry. Now I'm going to skip this part just for the sake of time, but the point here is that in terms of methodology, the methodology is different, but the reasoning is that undergirds the methodology is the same when we try to establish the anthropic principle in physics and in chemistry. In physics, we are doing a theoretical analysis where we're doing highly quantitative comparisons of what happens when you're varying constants of physics. Whereas in chemistry, what we're doing is a qualitative comparison by comparing carbon, this in this case with silicon or with other atoms, if you want to go through that exercise. But it's an experimental determination. So even though it's qualitative, it's actually, I would argue, more robust to argue for an anthropic principle in chemistry because it's established through experimental work. And this is the same reasoning that we're going to use now to look for evidence for the anthropic principle in biochemistry. And what we see here is that our criteria are going to be that the molecular systems that define life, terrestrial biochemistry, are specified fundamentally by the laws of physics and chemistry. That is to say that they are not the outworking of a historically contingent chance evolutionary process, but they are fundamentally prescribed by the very nature of the universe itself. That these properties are precisely what is needed for life, and that there's no alternative biochemistries that are conceivable. Okay, so let's go ahead and look for evidence for the anthropic principle by looking at proteins as a case study. And the reason why we're going to look at proteins today is, as Michael Denton said in his in an essay in a book called The Fitness of the Cosmos for Life, if the cosmos is uniquely fit for life as it exists on Earth, then given their primal significance, proteins should be another uniquely fit ensemble of natural forms. In other words, if you're going to see the anthropic principle anywhere, it should be with proteins. And the reason for this is because proteins are what I like this to call the workhorse molecules of life. Proteins are critical for cellular function and the formation of cellular structures. Proteins are taking part in virtually every operation in the cell. They're mediating all the different activities in the cell, and they are playing a key role in forming cellular structures. Even the simplest cell that can exist independently in the environment requires somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000 distinct unique proteins in order to carry out all the operations required for life. And typically cells will have many, many thousands of unique and distinct proteins that are part of its repertoire, part of its machinery. And so if you're going to see the anthropic principle, the first place to look is with proteins. Now, proteins, just as a quick review, are these large complex molecules that are formed by linking together smaller molecules in a head-to-tail manner. These are called amino acids. And so there are 20 different amino acids that are used to first approximation to build protein chains. And these amino acids are linked together to form a linear chain. And then the backbone of the chain can adopt specific conformations. The two most common are the alpha helix and the beta pleated sheet. And these secondary structures then will interact in space to form three-dimensional structures that make up the protein. And then these individual folded proteins can interact with others to form complexes. These are called, this is referred to as the quaternary structure of proteins. And we will see in This every level of protein structure seems to be fundamentally dictated by the laws of nature and is precisely what is needed for life to be possible. So let's take a look here. This is a table showing the 20, what are called the 20 canonical amino acids. These are the amino acids that universally make up proteins across all living organisms. And these amino acids vary in size, they vary in shape, they vary in solubility in water and organics, they vary in terms of charge, in polarity, and in the chemistry of the amino acids. So it's a rich diversity of physical and chemical properties that are represented by this set. And the way that the protein chain is built is that the carboxylic acid subunit, or sorry, check that functional group of one amino acid reacts with the amino functional group of another amino acid and in the process eliminates water. This is called a condensation reaction. And the net result is a linkage called a peptide bond, or technically it's an amide linkage or an amide bond. And this process is repeated over and over and over again until the protein chain is built to its final length. And a typical length for proteins may be anywhere from 100 to several hundred amino acids in length, depending on the specific protein that we're looking at. Now, the question becomes, are proteins unique? And I'm kind of jumping the gun here just a little bit, because I want to highlight the special and unusual nature of the amide bond. The amide linkage is a commonly occurring chemical bond in organic chemistry, but it is a really unusual chemical bond. And to highlight how unusual it is, we're going to compare essentially molecules made by linking together amino acids with large molecules made by linking together what are called alpha hydroxy acids. If there's going to be an alternative to proteins, it's going to be large polymers made up of alpha hydroxy acids. These are the closest chemical analogs to amino acids, where instead of an amino group, there is a hydroxyl group in the molecule. Now, the reason why this is really important is because if you guys remember the Stanley Miller, the Miller-Urey experiment carried out by Stanley Miller at the University of Chicago in the 1950s, where he sets up a glass apparatus that simulates the conditions of the early Earth and sends an electrical discharge through a headspace of gases and amino acids form as a result. Well, it turns out that in that experiment, alpha hydroxy acids formed also, and they actually formed at higher levels. And so just in terms of prebiotic availability, assuming that that experiment has relevance to the origin of life, let's just grant for a moment that it does. In terms of prebiotic availability, we'd actually expect alpha hydroxy acids to be at a higher concentration on the Earth, meaning that if evolution is going to produce large molecules to carry out different activities in support of life, that it really should have selected alpha hydroxy acids, not alpha amino acids. Well, it turns out, I'm jumping the gun here just a smidgen. These alpha hydroxy acids can form a chemical linkage between a hydroxyl group and a carboxylic acid group. And that end product is called an ester, whereas when a carboxylic acid reacts with an amine, which is the case for amino acids, that linkage is called an amide linkage or an amide functional group. And so here's a diagram showing lactic acid, which would be an analog to the amino acid alanine, reacting through a condensation reaction to form polylactic acid, which would be an analog to polyalanine. And so it's forming these ester linkages. The problem is that polyesters would never work in the role that proteins play inside the cell. And the reason for that is because the ester linkage has a single bond character, whereas the amide linkage has a double bond character. And this double bond character is what makes the amide linkage so unusual, so unexpected in its properties. And it's due to a phenomena that I'm not going to get into called resonance, that is a manifestation ultimately of the electronegativity differences between carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen. And because of those differences, polyamides will form bonds with double bond character, whereas polyesters will form bonds with single bond character. This is significant because, number one, a polyamide or a protein backbone or a peptide bond is less susceptible to hydrolytic breakdown. Polyesters will break down very readily in water. That's not obviously a good thing for a biomolecule. Now, because there's a double bond character, there's a planar geometry to the amide linkage, whereas in a polyester, it's a tetrahedral geometry. So it's a very different geometry because of the difference in the bond character, whether it's single bond or double bond character. But this gives rigidity to the backbone because the around that double bond, there can't be any kind of rotation. The rotation is restricted. Whereas around a single bond, the rotation can occur freely. So think about two boards that you would join together by a single nail. You can rotate those boards relative to one another. But if you drive a second nail into that, those boards can't move. And that's what's going on with the amide linkage. But that lack of rotation and the planar geometry actually gives rigidity to the backbone, allowing proteins to fold into stable three-dimensional structures. Polyesters have too flimsy and too flexible of a backbone to form these stable three-dimensional structures. Also, this bond allows for what's called a transgeometry, and it creates also what are known as steric constraints. So here again is the resonance phenomena that generates this double bond character in the amide linkage. Now, when you've got an amide linkage with, again, that double bond character, what it means is that there can be two configurations for substituents around the double bond. One is called cis and one is called trans. In the cis configuration, which is shown on the left, you see the two methyl groups in this particular amide on the same side of the bond. In the trans geometry, the methyl groups are on the opposite side. It turns out the nature of the amide bond in proteins only allows for the trans configuration. And this is really significant because what it does is it positions the carbonyl oxygen and the hydrogen on the nitrogen in the just right positions in space to allow for stabilizing beta pleated sheets and alpha helices. Now, in addition to that, you have, in addition to the amide linkage, you also have adjacent to it two other chemical substituents that are bonded by single bonds to that amide bond, and they can rotate freely. These are called the phi and the psi bond angles. But it turns out because of the amide linkage, it creates what are called steric constraints that limit the rotation of those other bonds, and they only will rotate in space in such a way to allow for the formation of alpha helices and beta pleated sheets. So in other words, you've got this really, really, this really unusual, bizarre chemical bond in the amide linkage. And what it does is it uniquely gives proteins a resistance to hydrolysis. It makes the backbone rigid to allow for stable folding. It forces chemical constituents in the right orientation in space to allow for stabilizing hydrogen bonding for secondary structures. And it creates steric constraints that only allow certain folding of the backbone in such a way to produce alpha helices and beta pleated sheets, which we see in proteins. This is what Banvenar and Martin say about this really unusual set of occurrences. And let me pull up the quote here. I'm not going to be able to read it on this computer screen. Okay, this is what they say. And Banvenar and Martin are two biophysicists, by the way. One cannot marvel at how several factors, the steric interactions, hydrogen bonds, which provide the scaffolding for protein structures, the constraints placed by quantum chemistry on the relative lengths of hydrogen bonds and covalent bonds, the near planarity of the peptide bonds, and the key role played by water reinforce and conspire with one another to place proteins in this novel phase of matter. And so this is suggesting an anthropic coincidence, because it's the alpha helix and the beta pleated sheet structures are ideally suited to form these a wide range of protein folds that are needed for life to be possible. Now, we also see further evidence of constraints on protein structure as well as anthropic coincidences when we consider higher order protein structures, that the tertiary structures or the three-dimensional structures of the folded protein chain. Because up to this point, we've talked primarily about the secondary structure. And to appreciate this, we need to think about something called protein space. And protein space could be essentially a space that defines all the possible structures for a particular protein of a particular amino acid length, sequence length. So if we say, for example, there's a protein of 150 amino acids, there would be 20, because there's 20 canonical amino acids, to the 150th power possible sequences. That would be part of protein space. But as it turns out, each protein chain can fold in a large number of different ways, at least theoretically. So a protein made up of 150 amino acids can fold in 10 to the 68 possible ways. All right, and so this is a massive amount of space where you have 20 to the 150th power, and that then in turn raised to the 68th power. It's a huge amount of space that you have available for possible protein structures. Well, it turns out that we only have discovered about a few thousand protein folds. This would be protein three-dimensional structures. And so it's a very, very imperceptible portion of protein space that is actually occupied by proteins in nature. It also turns out that each of these folds displays a wide range of different types of functionality, and different amino acid sequences can produce the same fold. All of this to say that it looks like there's some kind of physical chemical forces that are constraining the way that proteins fold into three-dimensional space. And it turns out that we understand why that is, because the secondary structures that are, again, dictated by all these different constraints arising out of the nature of the amide bond, in turn can only interact with each other topologically in certain ways. And so this limits the number of ways in which you can have three-dimensional structures. A famous chemist by the name of Kothia said the helices and sheets packed together in one of a small number of ways, the connections between secondary structures obey a set of topological rules. And so this is manifesting as a result of the laws of nature. But it turns out that the folds that are produced are exactly what you need for life to be possible. Now, there is another way that we can think about the constraints on the tertiary structure of proteins. And this is based on a study done by Banvenar and Martin, where they did a theoretical study where they looked at the geometry of the protein chain as a and its hydrophobicity profile. I'll explain what that is in a minute, as the two parameters that they would vary, and then looked at how protein chains would fold. And so they said, imagine that you have a flexible tube that you've created by linking together small disks, tethering that small disks together into a chain, right? That would be, where each of the disks would correspond to amino acids, and the tethering would be the linkage between them. And it's a flexible tube, it can flex. Now, the tube also has along its length different regions that have varying degrees of attractiveness and repulsiveness to water. And as a result of this, this chain is going to fold on itself into a compact structure. And the folding is going to be dictated in part by the hydrophobicity profile along its length. And they also defined what they called a folding parameter, which is the ratio of the diameter of the tube to the range of the interactions when the tube folds on itself. So this will become easier to understand if you think about extreme values of the folding parameter. If it's a very, very large value, then the tube would be too fat to fold, right? If it's a very, very small value, like a string, then there's a near infinite number of ways that the chain can fold. It turns out that they discovered that there is a sweet spot where the folding parameter turns out to be one. And at that point, you essentially get about 1,000 or so different folds that are possible due to steric constraints. And it turns out that when you look at the geometry of protein chains in nature, guess what the folding parameter is? It's one. The folding parameter for protein chains in nature is one. And it turns out that the folds that you observe in this theoretical study are identical to the folds that we've observed in nature. A phase at where X is about one is a special state because it means you have a tenuous balance between self-attraction and self-repulsion. You could think of this as being like a critical phase or a transition point. And as a result of that, proteins are going to very rapidly fold into their native state because of these physical chemical constraints that are arising out of the protein geometry, chain geometry. Now, this is significant because, remember, I said a single single protein chain of 150 amino acids can fold in potentially into 10 to the 68 possible ways. Now, when a protein is made at the ribosome, it has to fold into its native three-dimensional structure. If it had to randomly explore all that space, there's no way in the history of the universe a single protein would have the ability to fold into its three-dimensional structure. This is called the Lieben-Fall paradox. Well, it turns out that the resolution of that paradox is that there are physical chemical constraints that only allow the protein chain to fold in certain ways, meaning that proteins can very rapidly find their native state conformation. It also means that the protein is highly flexible. And this is really important for proteins to be able to operate during their catalytic cycle. This protein is going to be robust to mutations because changing the amino acid sequence, generally speaking, is not going to alter the folding pattern, but it also allows you to vary amino acid sequences to create a wide range of functionality. In other words, when you have a folding parameter of one, it gives you a just right set of properties that make these chains adopt not only the just right folds, but having a just right set of properties that allow them to be functional as the workhorse molecules of life. Again, Bandhanwar and Martin say this. The common belief is that given a sequence of amino acid with all the attendant details of the side chains and surrounding water, one obtains a funnel-like landscape with its minimum corresponding to its native state structure. Each protein is characterized by its own landscape. In this scenario, the protein sequence is all important and the protein folding problem needs to be attacked on a protein by protein basis. They go on to say, protein folds do not evolve. Rather, the menu of possible folds is predetermined by physical law. In that sense, it's as if evolution acts in the theater of life and shapes sequences and functionalities, but does so within the fixed backdrop of protein folds. Lastly, they say here, in contrast, our model calculations show that the large number of common globular proteins reflects a deeper underlying unity in their behavior. This landscape is pre-sculpted by general considerations of geometry and symmetry. And so, in other words, it's not just simply the secondary structure of proteins that's dictated by the laws of nature, but it's also the three-dimensional structure of proteins as well. Now, in addition to that, there's another place where we see, again, these anthropic coincidences, and this has to do with the surface features of proteins. Proteins don't have even surfaces, but they have pits and grooves and crevices and so forth on the surface. It turns out that some of these pits and grooves and crevices are places where small molecules will bind that will undergo chemical transformation or where proteins can interact with other proteins. And it turns out that there's only a limited number of what are called active sites and protein binding sites that are actually possible because of, again, physical constraints. And so it's even the surface features of the proteins that seem to be constrained by the laws of nature, and they are exactly what you need for life to be possible. The scientists that discovered this said this: the coincidence of structurally similar pockets and structurally similar proteins with similar patterns of residue conservation cannot in and of itself be used to infer evolutionary relationships between proteins. In other words, it doesn't look like proteins evolved, but rather are fundamentally dictated by the very laws of nature itself. Last point, and then we'll wrap it all up here. But now, what about the 20 different amino acids? It turns out that there's about 500 or so amino acids that can exist, that we know that can exist. And yet there's only 20 that are found in proteins. And it turns out that there is a good reason for why these amino acids were essentially used. They have to be amino acids. They can't be alpha hydroxy acids, or you can't form peptide chains by reacting diacids and diamines. I'm not going to get into the technical details. You can't have beta, gamma, delta, or N-alkyl amino acids. And you must have a hydrogen in the alpha position. In other words, the you must have an alpha hydroxy amino acid with a hydrogen in one of the positions, bonded to one of the positions in the alpha carbon. That is a core requirement in order to have amino acids that will make proteins. And it turns out that the chemical diversity that we see and the physical diversity that we see with amino acids is due to something called the R group that's bound also to the alpha carbon. And it turns out that this is the right set of R groups with respect to size, charge, and hydrophobicity. The biochemist that discovered this said the amino acids found in proteins form a highly unusual set of 20 amino acids. A maximum of 0.03% random sets outperformed the standard amino acid alphabet in two properties, while no single random set exhibited greater coverage in all three properties. In other words, every detail of the protein structure is absolutely critical for life to be possible. That the amide bond, which joins together, that the canonical set is the just right set that has the just right properties. And there's not any other combination of amino acids that's going to lead to viable proteins. That the bond between those amino acids is an amide linkage, and that has a really unusual set of properties that create just right sets of properties that allow for the formation of secondary structures. And it turns out that those interactions between the secondary structures and the geometry of the protein chain limit the ways in which it can fold in three-dimensional space. And that in turn, again, it appears to be constrained by the laws of nature, but it gives you the just right set of properties needed for life to exist. And even the surface features are constrained, but again, they're the just right properties. So what we've seen here is that proteins seem to be not the product of historically contingent evolutionary history, but seem to be fundamentally specified by the laws of nature. These systems are precisely what you need, and there's not any kind of alternative. So in other words, if you're going to find life out there, it's going to have to be based around proteins. And proteins are a non-negotiable in terms of living systems. But again, this is eerie because it suggests design and purpose in biochemistry. And this is essentially the same kind of reasoning that would be used to establish the anthropic principle in physics. The cosmological constant assumes the just right value for life to be possible. It's fundamentally dictated by the very nature of the universe, and there's no alternative values that it can assume it for life to exist. So it's the same kind of reasoning that would lead you to conclude design and purpose in the universe. And by the same extension, we see that same kind of reasoning here in biochemical systems. And by the way, in the book Fit for a Purpose, I also look at nucleic acids, DNA and RNA. I look at the process by which proteins are made, in which nucleic acids are made. And then I also look at cell membranes and then what's called the energy harvesting pathways. These are the core pathways that are necessary for life to exist. And what we see is in all of these systems, we see, in a sense, a very strong signal for the anthropic principle. So anyway, I'm going to go ahead and conclude here and give you guys an opportunity to engage. I understand that this was a little bit on the technical side and I went a little bit fast. So I recognize that. But part of the challenge here is that this idea of these anthropic coincidences isn't necessarily broadly accepted by biologists and biochemists. Many of them would argue that biochemistry is really the outworking of a historically contingent evolutionary history where chance has just imprinted itself on life. And so part of my challenge is I've actually got to demonstrate that there really are these constraints that are dictating the structure of biochemistry and then in turn, show that there is a uniqueness to biochemistry as well. So anyway, the floor is yours now.
Okay, actually the floor is still yours, but I'm gonna be tossing things on it for you to play with.
Okay.
The first one is the question that I have that comes from your introduction of the number of the protein space, the 10 to the 68th possibilities is a staggering number. And then it's constrained by physical constraints. So how would it be that the naturalist could not say that, well, we don't have to worry about evolution creating this. We've already got the constraints on the proteins. So the proteins are just going to happen. And of course, we're going to have life.
Yes. Well, this is, I wouldn't say the weakness, but this is the common rebuttal to the anthropic principle as an argument for design in the universe and purpose in the universe. As I mentioned, the way that Brandon Carter, who conceived the anthropic principle, understood the meaning of the anthropic principle was that, well, of course, we have to live at the just right time in the just right location with the just right physical constants, because if we didn't, then there wouldn't be observers in the universe to recognize that the universe wasn't suitable for life, right? And so he argued that it's a tautological type of reasoning, but he said, of course, that's the explanation. Along comes Barrow and Tipler about a decade later, and they refer to that reasoning as the weak anthropic principle. And then with the strong anthropic principle, they argue that the universe is the way that it is because there's some kind of fundamental mandate that's dictating the universe to be this way. And so they start to introduce this idea of teleology into the nature of the universe, which then lends itself to a design argument that if there's a creator that intended the universe to have life, then he would have made the universe in such a way that it's just right for life to exist and that there is no possible alternative. In a sense, you see that same problem when you're making the biochemical anthropic principle argument, and that is that one response would be that this looks like it's designed. The other response would be, well, that nature is rigged in such a way to naturally lead to this output. You don't need evolution. It's really the physical laws that are determining everything, right? And of course it's this way because if it wasn't this way, then life wouldn't exist and we wouldn't know it any other way. We wouldn't know that, right? Because we wouldn't exist. But to me, I think that really sidesteps the issue. I've heard my friend Ken Sample say, well, it seems a bit like a red herring to me in that you're really sidestepping the question. And that question is, why is the universe this way? It's not because I think everybody accepts the weak anthropic principle, regardless of your worldview. Of course, if the universe wasn't this way, there wouldn't be observers here, right? But that doesn't really answer the question, why is it rigged this way? That really is the question. And I don't think just simply saying, well, physical law or the origin of life is predetermined somehow skirts the issue, because you're now saying, even if it was an evolutionary process, quote unquote, or a mechanistic process that produced life apart from a creator intervention, you can't get away from a creator playing some kind of role, because the creator jimmy-rigged things from the very onset. Sure. You know, and in fact, as I worked on the book, I came to realize that there very well could be an anthropic principle in prebiotic chemistry too, which is really weird. But it's, in other words, that it, even if you assume a chemical evolutionary origin of life, there's a lot of things where there's these eerie coincidences where the just right chemistry seems to be, happen, producing the just right molecules that make, that would essentially allow for the emergence of life, right? You know, and so for example, we talked a little bit about alpha hydroxy acids being probably, you know, based on the Miller-Urey experiment, they should be more prominent on Earth than amino acids. Yet we see proteins made up of amino acids. And, you know, and it turns out that you could argue that because these amino acids had this really unusual set of properties, and because, you know, of the unusual nature of the amide linkage, when you start to get proteins to form, they basically are going to be persistent, whereas anything else isn't going to be. So even though you may have a really complex chemical soup, the laws of nature are producing these just right molecules that somehow, you know, are poised to go to the next step in chemical evolutionary history. And that's kind of like an anthropic coincidence, where you could have a scenario where you produce this chemical mixture, but nothing in there is suitable, right? That the laws of nature that are producing prebiotic reactions would only produce compounds that would be completely useless for chemical evolution. Isn't it eerie that the compounds you actually need wind up being, you know, in that set, and they wind up being persistent? So there's this sense that there might even be these anthropic coincidences, ironically, even in prebiotic chemistry. And in fact, I wrote a couple of blog articles in the last year or so, floating that idea. So one of them was just recently published on the Krebs cycle. Wow. You know, which is you know, something I discuss in the book as well as a core, you know, biochemical system. But anyway.
Okay, thank you. That was great. We have some questions from the audience. First one's from Keith Wilson. It says, "Hi Fuzz, thanks for your ministry. How do you handle Bill Craig's idea of mytho-history?"
Yes, I'm just reading the book now, and tomorrow, and I'm going to be speaking to our scholar community about my thoughts on that book. And then Wednesday afternoon, I'm going to be speaking to our apologetics community at Reasons to Believe about my thoughts on that book. And, you know, interestingly enough, this idea of mytho-history, this is Bill Craig, has just had a book published called In the Quest of the Historical Adam. And Bill Craig argues that Adam was indeed, based on what scripture teaches, was a historical person that was our primordial ancestor, our progenitor, and he was responsible for creating evil, moral evil in the world, or introducing moral evil into the world through his disobedience. And so he holds firmly that scripture teaches a historical Adam, and that you have to, if you're going to take the inerrancy of scripture seriously, you've got to recognize a historical Adam. In fact, he even argues, and I'm not going to get into the details here, that if you want to hold to the divinity of Christ, you also have to likewise hold to a historicity of Adam, because Jesus believed that there was a historical Adam. And if Jesus is omnipotent and omniscient, that he would realize that if there wasn't a historical Adam, he would know that that was not the case. And so for Jesus to think there was a historical Adam and there wasn't, essentially undermines his omniscience and therefore his divinity. So that's Craig's argument, at least my paraphrase of Craig's argument. I'm probably not doing it justice. So, you know, so to me, that's something that I think we would all, I think, find comfort in. is that particular view. Now, Craig, you know, argues that in order to begin to understand, you know, the historical Adam, though, we need to, because he figures prominently in Genesis 1 to 11, we need to understand the genre of Genesis 1 through 11. And so what Bill Craig does is he says, well, first of all, this, you know, work is anchored in the ancient Near East, right? And so, and he highlights a lot of the similarities between the ancient Near Eastern creation myths and Genesis 1 through 11. But he goes on beyond that, where he identifies what he would consider to be 10 criteria that all myths, at least myths in the ancient Near East, all held to. And he argues that Genesis 1 holds to all of those. And then he as part of that argument, he points out that there are a number of features in Genesis 1 through 11 that even the readers at that time would recognize that would be fantastic, that would be completely beyond plausibility. And therefore, they must have been understood in a literary sense, in a mythical sense or figurative sense, not in a literal sense. And he talks about a talking snake in the Garden of Eden. He talks about, you know, the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, the long lifespans, you know, the size of the ark, the number of animals on the ark. He highlights that there's inconsistencies in the Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 accounts in terms of the nature of God. Genesis 1, God being transcendent. Genesis 2, God being anthropomorphic, in the same way that gods are anthropomorphized in other ancient Near Eastern myths. And so he argues that this, in effect, renders Genesis 1 through 11 as being, in effect, mythical, you know, and that it would be a sacred narrative, but it was read and understood to be mythical. And then he points out, but yet you have things like a chronological sequence to Genesis 1 through 11, a chronological sequence to Genesis 1. So it's obvious that whoever wrote this was interested in, had historical considerations in mind. These were not just, you know, elements that are cobbled together, but this is a chronological presentation. He talks about the fact that there's genealogies that seem to make allusion to real people that existed. And in fact, he argues that these genealogies ultimately terminate in real people that would have known to exist. So he argues that there's a historical element to it as well. And so he argues that it belongs in a category called mytho-history. So that's in effect his argument. And he points out that there's a number of evangelical scholars who have, in a sense, arrived at the same conclusion, though they don't call it mytho-history. So Gordon Wenham talks about proto-history. Jack Collins calls it a worldview story. Walton and Longman refer to it as theological history. And so he argues that these are all, in effect, differences distinctions without differences, I'm sorry, that these are, in effect, describing mytho-history. So, you know, he is making an argument that this is becoming an emerging consensus, you know, and so, you know, at this point, you know, my assessment of at least the, my assessment of the claim that it's mytho-history, I think sidesteps the fact that there are these very clear features in Genesis 1 through 11 that, again, seem to reflect chronology, the fact that you're seeing chronology, the fact that you're seeing genealogies that seem to be describing real persons, to me, says that you could also understand it as well as historical. And some of the elements that he seems to be most troubled by, that he refers to as fantastical, are things that Hugh has addressed, I think, very capably in Navigating Genesis. So he seems to sidestep or simply dismiss any work done by other biblical scholars like Hugh or others, like let's say even Robert Newman, for example, who, you know, show this strong, you know, who respond to the concern that these elements are fantastical and can't be understood quote unquote, in a literal sense, you know, and, you know, so, I mean, that would be my response. Plus he's also, I think, stripping away that the particularly Genesis 1 account by simply ignoring the remarkable correspondence between, you know, the Earth's history and life's history on Earth and what we see in Genesis 1. So he's throwing that away or dismissing that as being essentially, you know, illegitimate. And so, you know, to me, I think there are good reasons why, you know, one should be, I think, skeptical of that approach. You know, it's not to say that there isn't, that Genesis 1 through 11 can't be considered to be mythic, functioning as a sacred narrative, but just because it's functioning as a sacred narrative doesn't mean that it has to be understood in a literary sense or a figurative or metaphorical sense. We can still understand it in a literal sense, even if it is functioning, you know, as a sacred narrative, you know, that is providing primordial history that is anchoring, you know, all of reality that with respect to the world that we know. So just because it's something is mythic or mythical doesn't mean that it can't necessarily be historical and be true. So I would argue that the same line of evidence that Craig uses to argue that there's a historical consideration at work could just be extended to say this is actually a historical passage of scripture. And you know, there's this the formula that you see throughout Genesis 1, you know, this is the generations of that formula that you see, you know, extends you know, throughout Genesis 1, and elsewhere it's understood as essentially providing a marker, a historical marker, right? An indication that what's following is a historical narrative. So there's, you know, those. So to me, I don't know that I would necessarily buy his idea of mytho-history. But what Bill Craig has done is he's bought into an evolutionary account of human origins. And so if you're going to try to square an evolutionary account of human origins with the Genesis 1 through 11 account, and you want to preserve inerrancy, you've got to go down the path of it's mytho-history, or it is, it's, you know, historical theology, or it's a worldview story, or it's proto-history, right? You have to go down that path because, you know, to say that this is a literal history means that you then have to recognize that there was a historical Adam and Eve who was the first human being. He and Eve were the first human beings, and that they gave rise to all of humanity, that they are the sole progenitors of all humanity, and that they were made through a direct intervention, that you'd have to reject an evolutionary framework. And so I think in the book, Who Was Adam, we show how you can still, you know, treat seriously the discoveries of anthropology, and yet also retain kind of a historical and literal reading of you know, Genesis 1. And of course, Hugh does the same thing in Navigating Genesis for Genesis 1 through 11. So I don't know if that helps, Keith, but that would be kind of my reaction, you know, to that.
Thank you. Craig McMahon has a couple of technical questions. The first one is, what characteristics distinguish a peptide from a protein?
I mean, it's pretty fluid. You know, a peptide, you know, the bond between amino acids is called a peptide bond. It's also an amide linkage. And so when you have a sequence of amino acids that typically are on the shorter side, you typically will refer to those as peptides, whereas a protein tends to be a much more larger chain. And that oftentimes that chain is interacting with other chains, you know, sometimes you might hear a single protein chain referred to as a polypeptide. So it's kind of nebulous, the difference between a peptide and a protein, where it kind of, the line really begins and ends.
Okay, thank you. Craig also asks, Does the anthropic principle specify a level chemistry versus a dextral chemistry for life?
That's a great question. I didn't look into that. I do know this, that if you have L amino acids, you have to have D sugars. And if you have D amino acids, you have to have L sugars. So there is a relationship between the stereochemistry of amino acids and the sugars that you see. But is D versus L actually preferred or dictated fundamentally by the laws of nature? I don't know the answer to that.
Thank you. Okay, that's fair. So there's a lot to not know, isn't there?
Yeah, unfortunately. Yeah. And I've mastered the non-knowing part.
Mark Durham wants to know whether your new book will cover all the concepts you've presented today. These are fantastic evidences of the biochemical anthropic principle.
Yes, yes. And there's even more in the chapter on proteins. So, yes.
Fantastic. Tim Williams asks, does the fitness of things like the protein make the origin of life problem any easier? Or are the problems working out a naturalistic origin of life independent of these anthropic items you described?
Yeah, you know, the last chapter of the book, I kind of play around with what are the implications, you know, of this idea. And, you know, I first of all, I think that this idea of an anthropic principle in biochemistry actually can help bridge theistic evolution and old earth creationism, because I think both perspectives could actually embrace this. You know, one of my big complaints about theistic evolution as it's oftentimes presented is that, well, you know, God is, you know, controlling the evolutionary process, but we just simply can't see any evidence for this, that God is doing this at the level of quantum indeterminacy. And so while God is guiding evolution, we don't really see any evidence for that whatsoever. And this bothers me because, you know, if that's the case, then what's the difference between theistic evolution and a materialistic version of evolution? It's indistinguishable, right? And I think people that advocate for TE like it that way because it protects their position. You can't disprove that God wasn't behind this, nor can you really prove that God is behind it. It's really a theological maneuver. But what I like about the anthropic principle is that if ultimately biochemistry is fundamentally dictated by the laws of nature, that it means that you now could argue that the origin of life was not the outworking of a historically contingent evolutionary process, but it was evolution that was preordained. The outcome of evolution was preordained at the very beginning of the universe. That if life was going to originate, it was going to inevitably originate, and it was going to look exactly like it looks now. Because this is the just right set of systems that you need for life to be possible. And so the fact that you see this anthropic principle means that even if you ascribe to an evolutionary view for the origin of life, you can't escape the role that a creator must play, right? And so I make that point that, and as I mentioned to Mark earlier, I think you actually very well may have anthropic coincidences connected with chemical evolution as well, which would be really, really interesting. And that would suggest that if you're adopting an evolutionary approach to the origin of life in light of the anthropic principle, this is not your grandfather's chemical evolution, and this is not your grandfather's theistic evolution either. This is essentially it's not random and historically contingent, but it's essentially has a very strong directionality, a very strong drive to a particular endpoint that is a highly optimal, just right endpoint. And it's hard to argue that there's not a teleology undergirding a process like that. So I think even if you embrace some form of evolution, you are looking at a very strong theistic evolution where you could actually say that this is evidence that there was that God had is in a sense purposing the outcome of evolutionary history. This is very clear, positive evidence towards that end. Now, what I do in the book, though, is I point out that in light of this, we still have the problem that I identified in the book, Creating Life in the Lab. And that is that while this chemistry that's necessary for the origin of life works very well in a laboratory, it doesn't work so well under the conditions of the early Earth. And this is because the success of prebiotic chemistry in the lab is determined by the oversight of the organic chemists. In other words, the organic chemists have infused themselves into the very design of the experiment. That intelligent agency is playing a direct role in the outcome of prebiotic reactions in the lab, and that this type of control wouldn't exist under the conditions of the early Earth. And so even if there are these prebiotic coincidences connected, you know, to aspects of chemical evolution, it still doesn't get you very far down the chemical evolutionary path, because in the absence of some kind of intelligent oversight rigging the conditions of the environment, you know, life isn't going to be possible. And so you could argue that in effect, maybe what the organic chemist is doing in the lab is setting up the just right set of conditions for life to be possible, and that you would need a mind to likewise set up the just right set of conditions on the Earth for chemical evolution to transpire, or that intelligent agent was involved in other ways, more direct ways to bring about the origin of life. And so I point out that particular issue really makes, really challenges, I think, a strict theistic evolutionary interpretation of the anthropic principle. Now, to me, the way I like to think about it is like a person designing a puzzle. That you have a puzzle. If you take a picture and you cut out different shapes, with the idea that these shapes are going to fit together in a just right way, you know, you can take those shapes and break them apart and then put them in a box and shake them up, and you're never going to get that puzzle to assemble. But because the shapes are just right, when you have an intelligent agent at work, that intelligent agent can fit those pieces together in such a way to produce the finished, to solve the puzzle, to produce the finished product. And that's how I would see the origin of life. That would be the analogy, is that the creator created, maybe even certain constraints that allowed for certain prebiotic reactions, and these reactions are going to produce the just right materials with the just right properties, but you still need a creator to come along and fit those things together to produce a living system, if you will, at least metaphorically, right? Fitting them together.
Thank you. Then we have no more questions, and we're up against our end time, so it's working out perfectly.
Good.
Fuzz, let us know one more time, what is the title of the book and when do we expect it?
Okay, so the book title is Fit for a Purpose. And the hope is that the first part of November, we should be able to have the book, in our warehouse at RTB. So we shall see.
Okay, and are you the sole author?
Yes.
Thank you. Yeah. All right, and for everyone else, this will be recorded and it will be loaded up to YouTube later on. So you'll be able to catch up on what you didn't catch while you were here, because a lot of material got covered. So thank you very much, Fuzz. You've been absolutely fantastic. The stuff that you've presented today was remarkable. Some of it is stunning, actually. So I'm looking forward to your book, and I'm very, very glad that you took your time with us today. Thank you very much, and Lord bless you.
Yeah, thank you, Mark, and for your hosting, and God bless all of you, too.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.